Good morning. Our topic this morning is The Big Story, from Marriage Love, sections 1 through 26. My name is Lee Wolfenden. We are here at the Freiburg New Church Assembly, and it is Saturday, August 11th, 2012, the first lecture. Those of you who are here yesterday will get a double dose of this story because, unbeknownst to either one of us, Garden and I picked the same wonderful story to do our lecture about, but we've talked about it and we're okay with it. So as long as you're okay with it, we're okay with it. I could put together another last-minute lecture, but I don't think I will. In my first lecture on Monday, I talked about how the memorable relations in Swedenborg's writings give the experiential basis, the practical experience of the spiritual world, so that we can understand what Swedenborg is talking about when he tells us about spiritual meanings in the Bible, when he tells us about our spiritual life. He says, without knowing what it's like in the spiritual world, you really can't understand these things, because that's where those things are real to our senses, where we can see as we live exactly what our spiritual life is all about. It gives us visual and experiential data that we can use to understand what the spiritual meaning of the Bible is and what our spiritual life is. And of no story is that more true than the opening story, the big, long, 26-number story that starts out the book Marriage Love. By this time, Swedenborg had already begun to publish his spiritual experiences after the chapters in Apocalypse Revealed. And I find it fascinating, just as a little side note, that there aren't any stories repeated between Apocalypse Revealed and Marriage Love. There are a number of stories repeated from both of those books to True Christian Religion, or True Christianity, his final published work. But everything in Marriage Love is new, and everything in Apocalypse Revealed is new. And further, very little of this material is taken from things he had previously written down, to the best that I can determine. Some of the later stuff in True Christianity is taken from his spiritual experiences, but most of the material that's published, the stories that are published in Apocalypse Revealed and in Marriage Love, have been not only published but written for the first time in those two books. So this was brand new material that he was bringing out at this point in his life, fairly late in his life. And he told us, though, at the very beginning of his first published book, that we did need to have these stories and this information about the spiritual world in order to understand all of the other things he was going to be teaching us. So I'm very glad we're doing this story, the memorable relations, the stories in Swedenborg this week. Now, the opening story in Love and Marriage, as I said, is probably the most clear and condensed version of that experience about the spiritual world that you're going to get. I would say that this opening story is sort of like the heaven part of Heaven and Hell without all the theory. Has a little bit of the theory, but almost all of the different experiential things that he talks about, angels' homes and houses, their occupations, worship, weddings, all these things appear in this one story. So if you don't want to have to wade your way all the way through Heaven and Hell and you just want the good stuff, pick up a copy of Marriage Love, read the first 26 numbers, and you've got the shorter Heaven and Hell right there in a very enjoyable and sometimes comical fashion, as we'll see as we go along. I'm going to give you a quick overview of the whole thing, a summary of the whole thing, and try to fit it within the half hour, and stop along the way to read you a little bit of it. But here's the basics of what this story is all about. He's telling us what heaven is and what's heavenly pleasure. What really is it to be in heaven? And he calls together a convocation on that subject, which we'll talk about. But before we get there, here's the general message of this whole big story. First, heaven is not about external pleasure, external power, or any kind of particular physical or even mental experience. We may think that we get pleasure from all these things, and we do get some pleasure, but as far as heavenly joy and happiness, it's not about the experience that we have or the feeling of power, any of that. Rather, heaven really is the love and wisdom that's within us, and the useful service we provide to others based on that love and service. After every single one of the so-called false heavens, people trying out their heaven, there's some form of heaven is all about providing useful service to others. That's where the real joy comes from, and all these other things are just incidental pleasures that refresh us, yes, and they're enjoyable, and we do engage in them, but they're not where heavenly pleasure and joy and happiness come from. However, heaven is also a place of freedom. The spiritual world is a place of freedom. We get to try out just about anything we want there. One of the things I'm really struck by as I read through is every time somebody wants to do something, they say, okay, you can do that. It may be stupid to do that, but you can do that. We're not going to stop you. You want to just go right up to heaven? Sure, no problem. Go right up to heaven. See what it's like. And they go up there and they find out. People there learn primarily by experience first, and then afterwards they may be ready to listen to somebody who actually knows what they're talking about. And that happens over and over as a pattern in this opening story. So let's take a look at the story itself. Now this story, as I said, is in Marriage Love Numbers 1 to 26. It's also repeated in True Christianity, number 731 to 752, but without the opening prologue and the epilogue that I'll tell you about in a minute. In that story, in True Christianity, just jumps right into the story, but here he's starting out with the story, so he has to give us a little bit of context, and I'm actually going to read you the first number, the first section in Love and Marriage, because this is a marvelous condensation of Swedenborg's whole, in a sense, who he was and what he was doing. He just condenses it down into this little statement. He writes, and these are the opening words of the book Marriage Love, "I foresee that many people who read the following chapters and the remarkable stories after each chapter are going to think that the stories are imaginative inventions. But I assert in truth that they are not invented, but really done and seen, and not when my mind was in a trance, but when I was wide awake. In fact, the Lord himself saw fit to let me see him and has sent me to teach things about the new church that the book of Revelation refers to as the New Jerusalem. To do this, he opened the inner levels of my mind for me, and this enables me to be in the spiritual world with angels and in the natural world with people at the same time, and this for 25 years now." So here, right in the opening number, he doesn't leave us in any suspense. He doesn't mamby-pamby around. I've seen it. This is from my own experience. And not only that, the Lord commissioned me. And this, I just noticed, having had, I believe it was Jim's question earlier about, did Swedenborg get... Did he get direction along the way about what his mission was? His early statements were all about how he was commissioned to explain the spiritual meaning of Scripture, and that's what he set out to do. But here I find it interesting that he says the Lord has sent him to teach things about the new church that the book of Revelation refers to as the New Jerusalem. So this commission actually covers all those topical works that we sometimes think Swedenborg took on himself. I think that kind of answers your question in a way that I hadn't really thought of at the time. He was also commissioned to teach us about the teachings of the New Jerusalem. So this is the prologue, and then we jump right into what heaven isn't. And the way this takes place is that there's a conversation between among some angels in one of the eastern heavens, which are the heavens of love, and they have had some new arrivals come from Earth, and these new arrivals have told them that people on Earth have no idea what heaven is all about. They don't have the slightest conception of what heaven really is. And these angels who are living it every day have a hard time believing that. So they say, okay, let's go down and call a convocation. So they send one of their guys down with a trumpet to the world of spirits, and he blows his trumpet north, west, south, and gathers together two groups from each direction in the world of spirits, which is where people first come after they die and are not quite ready for either heaven or hell. And we're told that these are the wisest, the most eminent, the most learned people from the world, and they get together two groups from each direction, and they get together and they face each other and they talk it out, and they didn't just sort of randomly come out with things. They really thought this out pretty heavily before they expressed themselves. And what follows is a listing of all of their six opinions, each one different as to what heavenly happiness and joy are. And these actually get listed twice, first in the order of the, you know, north, west, and south. But then when Swedenborg takes them up and gives them a chance to try it out, it goes in a different order. And in order to save time, I'm going to go by the second order so that we don't go 2 hours with this lecture. So here's the deal. Everyone who has an idea of heaven gets to try it out when they get into the other life, because there's nothing like experience to find out whether something really works or not. If we have an idea that we want to try out, somebody can tell us it's not such a good idea, but half the time at least we have to try it out anyway to find out for ourselves whether it's a good idea. So all of these people who have their different ideas of heaven get to try it out. Now I will say that these being the wisest, perhaps they could learn from the experience of others, because most of them did not actually themselves try out these heavens. What they did instead was they saw people who had tried them out and the results of that experience, and most of them were able to learn from the experience of others rather than having to go through the whole thing themselves. So having said all that, let's take a look at their different conceptions of heaven. The first one, the first group that actually gets to experience this, had come to the considered conclusion that heaven was pleasant company and agreeable conversation, that they would be in a place where they could talk about their favorite subjects with good people and do this for the rest of eternity. So very soon, an angel guide came along and took this group up to a place where people were trying out exactly that kind of heaven. And they go around to these different rooms and find, wow, there's some great conversation going on here. Whatever you want to talk about, politics, religion, sex, nature, you can find a room there and you can talk about other people, talk with other people who are interested in that same subject. So they get a quick tour of this house, and then they go to one of the entrances, and I'm saying that advisedly because there are some people by this entrance who are really distressed. They want to get out, and they can't get out because the door is locked, and they say, hey, can we get out of here? And they're told, this isn't an exit, this is an entrance. This is heaven, you're going to be here forever. And they are not happy about this because they've already been there a couple days, and they're getting a little bit tired of talk. They've talked and they've talked and they've talked, and they're ready to get out there and do something else. And so when they hear this is an entrance, not an exit, they really get very depressed. And finally, they are allowed out, and he says they ran back home to their work and occupation. They couldn't wait to get back to their jobs at home, because people do have homes in the world of spirits even before they get to heaven. All right. The next one is the idea that heaven is feasts with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the 12 apostles. And once again, it's a similar story. That group is brought to a place where this very thing is happening. It isn't the actual Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but it's people who are essentially actors, or they've gotten themselves sort of puffed up with pride, and they think they are those people. And so they see all these people sitting down at tables with these wonderful feasts, and then they meet some people who, once again, are trying to get away from this place. You know, what's wrong? Aren't you going to have you had your meal with all of them? You know, if you haven't, it'd be very rude not to eat with James and John if you haven't done that. And they say, we are stuffed. I can't eat another bite. There's no way that I'm going to sit down at one of these tables. Just let me out of this place. And similarly, they're finally allowed out, and they go running home. The next group actually does get to try out its so-called heavenly pleasures, and that's the ones who think that heaven is supreme power, wealth, prestige, and glory. And these guys actually get brought to this sort of supposed entryway to heaven, this colonnade where there's these thrones and seats, and they get to sit on them and put on these royal robes and have these royal scepters. And they sit there, and it says this mist of fantasy rose up from the ground, and they've got all puffed up thinking, I'm going to be a king, I'm going to rule over the nations and this sort of thing. And they sit there like this for 3 hours, and meanwhile, these were kind of wiseacres who enjoyed taunting people. They're saying, it's just going to be a little while longer. We're just preparing your palace for you. It's almost time. You're almost going to come in. We're almost ready, but you just have to wait a little bit longer. And they go this way for about 3 hours. And then finally, some angels look down from heaven and have pity on them and say, what are you guys doing here, play acting like this? This is ridiculous. And each time before they're released, they're given a little talk about how, yes, there are these sorts of things in heaven, but the real pleasure of heaven is to find your use and your service to other people and engage in that. And then you might be able to enjoy some of these other things also. We'll sort of zoom through the rest of them. The next one is that it's the delights of paradise. And once again, people, they are brought into this beautiful paradise garden, and they're sitting on rose beds and with all the fruits. And then they go and they find people who are trying to get out of the place. And this turns into a labyrinth where they can't find their way out. Every time they try to get out, they get buried deeper and deeper. And so they come upon this group who is very depressed. They've realized they made a mistake, and now they've been told they have to stay here forever. And the angel takes pity on them, who's the guide, takes pity on them, gives them a little instruction about what it really is, and then says, I know the way out, I'll show you. And he takes them through the maze, and they head home. The next one, which would be near and dear to my heart, perhaps, and to a few others, if we were a little bit more puffed up than we are, I think, is perpetual glorification of God in a continual religious holiday. And here they go to these great big churches where there are continual sermons, and you have to stay in the first one 3 days, and then you go through the doorway, and there's other sort of sub-churches, and then eventually you get to this grand temple in heaven where there's perpetual glorification of God. So the angel, who I think is also a bit of a comic, leads the people in and says, the people in this particular one have been here for 2 days. Just come in and look at their worship of God. And most of the people are snoring, they're yawning. It says some of them, their heads were sort of almost like lifting off their shoulders because their thoughts were so lifted up that they felt that they no longer were connected to their body. And finally, these people have had enough, and they actually rush the door, knock the guards down, push their way out, and go tearing out of there with the priest running, hey, wait, we haven't finished our sermon. And their priests are grabbing them and trying to bring them back. And they're having none of it, and they just tear themselves away and head home. So then the priests, actually, the ministers, get a little talking to themselves as well as the ones who are running home. Then the sixth one is, actually I've got these numbered, just getting into heaven. If I can just get into heaven, then I'll feel all of its pleasures and all of its joys. And I'm actually going to read you one of these because it is a parallel to the parable of the wedding banquet that I read to you in chapel just a few minutes ago. This is in section 10. And there are several. Once again, the wise people themselves didn't have to experience this. What happened in this instance was the angels called in several people who had tried that out. Their idea was, if I can just get into heaven, then I'll be able to taste its joys. So here's the first of several stories that they heard about what it was like just to get into heaven. So here's the first one. He says, my idea of heaven from early childhood until the end of my life in the world was that it would be a place of blessedness, happiness, enjoyment, delightfulness, and pleasure, and that if I was admitted, an aura of these delights would surround me and I would breathe them in with all my heart, like a bridegroom when he celebrates his wedding and when he goes to the bedroom with his bride. I went up to heaven, preoccupied with this idea, and I passed the first guards and the second ones too. Here's another instance where you get to do what you want. The guards didn't stop him. They probably knew it was going to happen, but they didn't stop him. But when I came to the third ones, the officer of the guard spoke to me and said, who are you, friend? Are they going to stop him here? I answered, isn't this heaven? I came up here to get my heart's desire. Please let me in. And he did. Okay, you want to go into heaven? You're welcome to go into heaven. Then I saw angels in white clothes, and they walked around me, looked at me, and murmured, what? This new guest does not have heavenly clothes on. I heard it, and I thought, I seem like the guest that the Lord said to that came to the wedding without a wedding garment. And I said, give me that kind of clothes. They just laughed. Then someone came running from the court with a command, strip him naked, throw him out, and throw his clothes after him. And so I was thrown out. The others all tell their story, and some of them ended out writhing like snakes because they couldn't stand the atmosphere and throwing themselves over cliffs. They were all quite dramatic. They found out that going to heaven without being ready for heaven was actually a torturous experience, and they simply couldn't stand the atmosphere there because it wasn't in accord with who they were inwardly, and they were also instructed about this. So these are all the different variations of the different heavens, which many of us have probably thought of at time. Boy, if I could just have as much money as I want and have a great home and a great car and people to serve me and all of that, then I would be happy and then I would be in heaven. These are very common conceptions of what would give us happiness, and they get to try them out and find out that, no, they don't really give us happiness. And we'll come back to that a little later. As the story goes on, we then get a picture of what heaven really is like, what it really is all about. 10 of the people from this convocation of 6 groups from the 3 directions other than east are chosen, 10 people to go up there and experience 3 days in heaven. And if you're wondering how they could do it, where these other ones couldn't, the Lord prepared them inwardly, prepared their minds or their psyches so that they could be in heaven for a period of 3 days, and it would not harm them in any way. So the rest of the story is about a visit to heaven, and it tells us about the various aspects of heaven, what it's like. It's broken into 3 different sort of categories for the 3 different days. First, there is a visit with the prince of this society. For those of you who know a little bit about the spiritual world in heaven, this is probably a community of the spiritual kingdom, where they do have magnificent palaces and that sort of thing, and they have princes and courtiers and these sorts of things, whereas in the celestial kingdom, they tend to live in more humble wooden abodes and not need all this these trappings of authority and the appearance of wealth. But the heaven that these people go to, of course, they're coming from a European culture, and the pinnacle of their culture is the nobility and the palaces and fine mansions that they live in. And so they're brought to a heaven that would be appropriate to the type of culture and life that they came from. This would be having arrived at the best that our culture can conceive of. And yet, when it's in the real heaven, it's taking place not in a false way of, I'm out for power, so I'm going to live in a palace, but rather, I want to serve, and I have the ability to serve in a greater way, and therefore I have this honor. And this is something that takes place on that, this is a conversation that takes place on that first day when they visit the prince. Now, when they wake up in the morning, they're all raring to go and saying, let's go see the prince. And they say, no, he's got work to do. He and his courtiers, everybody else, they have their jobs, and they need to spend the morning doing their business, so we're going to have to wait. And you'll get to sit down to lunch with them. So meanwhile, they're given a tour of the palace and of the surrounding area. They see wonderful, magnificent things. In fact, it says that some of them, they're so incredible that no human being made them or could have made them, that God himself actually made these objects and placed them there in order to express something of the wonders of the divine nature. And they can see meaning in these objects that are around the palace. So first they see the palace, and of course their jaws are dropping. They've never seen anything like it. It's more magnificent even than the most magnificent palaces in this earth. It would be simply impossible to build anything like this on this earth because the materials would be too crude. They then go outside. They see the palace garden, which is it's a spiral pattern. It has something like the Tree of Life in the middle, but it also has all different varieties of fruit trees, flowering trees, trees for wood. They're all arranged in a pattern, and they're just amazed at the beauty of this garden. And then in the afternoon, they have conversations with wise people about the nature of heaven. Of course, during the meal itself, they had had a conversation, and that's where the prince had informed them, the reason I'm in this position, basically, is that I am able and willing to serve in a higher capacity, and these other people are willing to serve in other ways. And all of this really doesn't mean anything. It's just the external trappings, and it's there because it establishes my authority, and that way people will listen to me, but I listen to God, and I do God's bidding in leading these people. That's sort of a paraphrase of some of the things that he said. So that's the first day, and what they're really learning here is what is heaven about? It's about engaging in your work and your occupation, providing useful service to others in whatever way you do that best. And that's the reality of heaven. Everything else is just relaxation and pleasures. It's R&R. We spend much of our life engaged in our work and occupations, and we take time off periodically to refresh ourselves. And it's precisely the same in heaven. The second day, they wake up to beautiful singing. It says women and young girls are singing, and they're singing a song that expresses the joy of marriage love. And they're told that today they're invited to a wedding, and they're quite happy about this. So they attend the wedding, and it's a very simple affair, beautiful but simple, and they see the bride and the groom come in together, and they give each other pledges, and they promise themselves to each other, and then they have their food and their drink, and it says that the bride and the groom went into the bridal chamber and closed the door. And so all the wedding guests then were left outside, and there were a number of conversations, one of which was that their angel guide invited, there were six young women who had attended the bride, and the angel guide thought it might be nice if these 10 visitors to heaven could have a little bit of talk with these young women. So he goes and he calls them and they come, but as soon as they get anywhere near these guys, they sort of shrink back and go back to their apartment. Well, he goes and says, what gives? You know, why did you leave? We said, we don't know, but we just couldn't come near these guys, you know, so please ask them to excuse us. So he goes back to them and he says, you know, they asked to be excused. They couldn't come here. I presume that you don't have the cleanest ideas about women. And they sort of laugh and say, well, that's true. Who could see such beautiful women and not feel some desire? That's their statement. So that was one of the little touches of humor, I think, in there. If you don't have a pure mind, you're not going to be able to have the friendly relations with these beautiful young women. And the angel tells them, we have many beautiful women, and we love them, but we love them chastely. In other words, we appreciate them for who they are, and we aren't thinking of them in the way that you're thinking of them. So they didn't get to have that conversation, but they do get to talk to others about what marriage is all about, that it's a union of two people, that it comes from God, the marriage of love and wisdom of God, and they're taught quite a bit about the marriage, and they ask questions about the ceremony, all of which you can find out if you actually read the story for yourself, and I highly recommend that. The third and final day of their stay, they are able to attend a worship service in heaven, and that description sort of has two parts. First, Swedenborg spends quite a bit of time describing the architecture of the building, which he calls a temple, depending on how you translate it. It turns out to be a big semicircular building with raised seating all around and a podium in the back, and he gives this whole description of the seating and how everybody has to sit in the right place, and if they don't, the minister gets confused and all this kind of stuff. And then he gets to the service, and I remember thinking, you know, when I first read it, here's where we find out what the services are really supposed to be like. Well, we've already been told that this service lasts 2 hours, and when we get to the actual service, it says the minister ascended the pulpit, and they don't actually call them ministers, by the way, they call them preachers. He ascended the pulpit, and he preached a sermon full of the wisdom of God about how the Holy Bible is the Lord's word, and it's dictated by him, and he showed fully that this was the case with great skill and wisdom, and then he said a prayer and descended the pulpit. So I'm thinking, what the heck, a two-hour sermon and a prayer, that's their service? But that's what's described. So he must have been a pretty good speaker, let's put it that way, to hold their attention for 2 hours. Or there's things Swedenborg didn't tell us about. But I suspect that that really was the service, because for these people, their life is their service of God, and they probably don't need a lot of the ritual that we may feel we need here. So after the service, they talk to the minister for a little while, and then their angel guide tells them, the Lord prepared you for 3 days. It's now been 3 days. So it's time for you to head home, so please go back to your rooms that have been assigned to you and take off the heavenly clothes. Remember the wedding robe? Take off your heavenly clothes and put on your own clothing. And once they did this, they were seized with a desire to head home. And they did, and they went back, and they told their friends about all the wonderful things that they'd seen in heaven and thanked the Lord for the mercy and the wonderful nature of his letting them experience this 3 days excursion in heaven. All right, so that's the story. And what I want to do for the last 1+ minutes that I have in my half hour is just to quickly trace through how this actually does tell our story here on earth. Our topic for this week is not only the memorable relations, but how these memorable relations speak to our memorable relations here on earth, the things that we experience. And as we look at this story, we find out that in many ways it does tell the story of our life here on earth. So here's a quick outline of how I think maybe this is true, and then perhaps in the discussion group, some of you may have some further insights on this. Here on earth, we start out in life with an idea of what is it we want to do and what do we think is going to make us happy. And when we're young and haven't experienced life much, we often come up with some ideas that if we were older and wiser, we would realize that's not really going to give us happiness. And yet, God knows that we have to try things out for ourselves, so we are allowed to try out the things we want, to direct our lives in the way that we think we should go, that's going to give us happiness, that's going to give us fulfillment. And I believe we spend much of our young adult life and into our middle-aged years trying out what is going to give me happiness, what is going to make my life a good life. We have to try these things out and experience them for ourselves, because if we didn't, we would never really believe the genuine answer, which we take a long time coming to. So much of our early life is spent, and I would extend this back into our childhood as well, much of our life is spent trying to figure out how can I be happy, and trying out different things that we think are going to make us happy. Often they involve money or power or prestige, scholarly prestige, different things that we think are going to make us happy. It's not all bad. We usually are providing some good service along the way, but quite often we find that things we thought we wanted to do with our lives, the thing we thought would make us happy, aren't making us happy, and we realize along the way, my life is sort of empty. I really haven't figured it out. I just don't understand what this life is all about. But it's at that point that, having tried out our own ideas, we think, well, maybe I should look deeper. Maybe I should go to the spiritual experiences of the world's great teachers, go to the Bible, go to Swedenborg, try to figure out what is life really all about. And that's when we first begin to experience the actual heaven, and we find, as we go along in general, that we only find real lasting happiness if we find some way that we ourselves can enjoy serving others, that we ourselves can do something that does express ourselves but is also doing good for others. We find our joy finally in having a job, an occupation, an avocation, volunteer work, whatever it is, that does good for others, and that this gives us our real pleasure. And once we have that dedication to serving other human beings, then we can really enjoy all those other things that we thought earlier were going to give us pleasure, because all these other things are good. It's good to have enough money to live. It's even good to have a little extra. It's good to enjoy pleasant conversation. It's good to enjoy nature. It's good to enjoy all of these things that these people had said they thought was the basis of heaven, but they're not the fundamentals. The fundamental is the love and the understanding we have within ourselves and expressing that in loving service to other people. And in one way, we could say that this whole memorable relation is really an illustration of one of Jesus' other statements. And I'm going to read in closing from Matthew 6, 25 to 33. Jesus says, "Therefore I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat or what you will drink, or about your body, what you will wear. Is not life more than food, and the body more than clothing? Look at the birds of the air. They neither sow nor reap nor gather into barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not of more value than they? And can any one of you, by worrying, add a single hour to the span of your life? And why do you worry about clothing? Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They neither toil nor spin. Yet I tell you, even Solomon in all his glory was not clothed like one of these. But if God so clothes the grass of the field, which is alive today and tomorrow is thrown into the oven, will he not much more clothe you, you of little faith? Therefore do not worry, saying, 'What will we eat, or what will we drink, or what will we wear?' For it is the Gentiles who strive for all these things, and indeed your heavenly Father knows that you need all these things. But seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all of these things will be given to you as well." The floor is yours.
It's the process, not the actual static being. So it's a process of seeking heaven, not the actual being of arrival.
Yes, that would be a great way to put it as well. It's not just a state of being, it's actually the process. And this is something I think was a little bit radical that Swedenborg said, is that just because you're in heaven, it doesn't mean that the process stops. In fact, heaven is a continuation of everything good about this life, including some of the struggles, including the striving. It's another translation of this is strive for the kingdom of God and its righteousness first. And that striving never ends. We're always trying to move farther along the path, gain more insight, and be more able to love our fellow human beings.
I'm working with college students right now. A lot of them are afraid to go to a new location and start. And I think maybe they lack confidence in their ability of process, just like sometimes we get on a fast river and we're not sure if we're going to be able to get around the corner. Mm-hmm. And I know somebody that's afraid to die because they're afraid to go to heaven and meet someone they don't like.
Ah. Yeah.
Thank you.
You do get to hang out with the people that you most want to hang out with, although I will say that there are people in heaven who also hang out with people that are not so great. There are actually angels who are essentially prison guards for the devils in hell, and that's what they do during that period of the morning or however long it is that they do their work. So it's even heaven is not actually all sweetness and light. But as far as being forced to be with people that you don't want to be with, that would be reserved for hell. I'm going to call on Ian over here.
I'd like to make an announcement first. For those of you who may not know, we are recording these lectures and your comments. So for the sake of the people that are listening to the recording, please say who you are and please use the microphone.
Well, I'm Mrs. F. Robert Doppel. I'm Dr. Schallenberger.
Ian Wolf, simple question, Lee. So what's different here?
Not as much as we think. That's my conclusion. Not as much as we think is different. There is a little more sortation there. People do sort themselves out. You're not quite as mixed in together with people with a very disparate personalities, unless that's what you like. But I think one of Swedenborg's main messages is that heaven is really a continuation of this life in almost every way. That what we do here is we set our general direction, and what we do here is also we practice and we develop when we learn. When you're learning to drive, yes, you have your classroom portion, but much of your learning to drive is actually driving. And when you get your license, you continue to drive. You just do it a little better, we hope, than you did while you had your learner's permit. So I think not a whole lot. One thing I will say, though, is that once you reach heaven, you are very clear who you are and what you're doing. Here we tend to still be striving and trying to figure that out in many ways. We figure it out sort of kinesthetically in that we're actually doing things, but we haven't always clarified our mind as to what am I doing, who am I, and what am I doing here. And I think that's probably a little clearer to us in heaven.
Would that be a judgment? Would that thin things down and slow us up from the transition?
Would which?
Well,
I used to think that our life here on Earth was like taking an arrow and putting it in a bow, and you point it in a certain direction, you let go, and the arrow just flies in that direction to eternity. I don't think that way anymore. Some of you have heard me say this before. I now think of it more as a cone of probability in terms of physics, where our life here sets us in a certain general direction. But in physics, there's this thing called the cone of probability, where if you see a particle at a certain place going in a certain direction, it could go anywhere within a particular cone that stretches outward, and it's going to sort of make decisions, quote-unquote, along the way, and that's going to send it more this way or more that way. I've come to believe that in the spiritual world and even in heaven, we actually do make real life-changing decisions along the way. We're not going to choose to go to hell instead of heaven. That general direction is set. But we may actually make career decisions along the way and decide, you know, I've raised children long enough. I want to try something else for a while. Maybe I'm going to be in a support role. Maybe I'm going to be doing something different. For example, if we've gone into here on Earth, if we've gone into the medical field, we may stay with the medical field, but we might go into different specialties. So I've come to believe that even in heaven, we actually do make decisions along the way that change our course and cause the rest of our life to be different than it would have been if we had made a different decision. I have Guard over here, and then George.
Guard Perry. I've heard answers or responses to Ian's question over the years, one of which I found real helpful when I heard it for the first time, is what's the difference between the life in heaven, which is apparently so similar as our life on earth, which is that in life on earth, the external environment is actually solidified or fixed or shared as an external so-called reality, so that when we look across the veil, the interveil, we see Kearsarge.
Mm-hmm.
Kearsarge is a conical shape that's actually there, so to speak. I mean, actually, it really is there. Let's put it that way, as an external feature of our environment. Well, I would be irritated if someone were to go down that path. The point is that... The point is that is the difference between the physical world and the spiritual world, is that because we're beginners, this is the answer I'm repeating that I've heard actually from people in the room, because we're beginners in the spiritual life, the Lord in his wisdom created an earth for us that is relatively fixed and dense and permanent, so to speak, And so we can agree on that, and then we bounce up against that hard reality, which creates real boundaries. You know what I'm saying? And those real boundaries are the way our mind can gradually develop until we don't need so many real boundaries, and then we begin to realize as the psyche matures that we can recognize our projections onto the environment, which is a psychological process. So, and then we say, oh, I'm projecting onto that scene what I see in it. And when we recognize that, and we then allow other people to project their interpretations of what's beautiful and what's not, or this is what I heard in your lecture, someone else heard something different.
Mm-hmm.
Again, we're going within now. And then eventually the life of heaven would be as described. Anyway, I'll leave it at that. The difference that I heard was helpful in heaven, what a person sees is actually a projection of their spiritual state. Whereas here, we don't have to live in a world that's that fluid. We get to practice in a world that's much more stable. Okay.
I think if I were to put that in my own words, it sounds like while our character is unsettled, we need something settled outside to kind of contain us. But once our characters are more settled, then we don't need that, and the outside world is... I don't believe it's actually a projection. Some people say you create your own reality. I would say rather God creates the reality that corresponds to what's in here. One way to conceptualize this is the difference between... our time in the womb and our time being born. In the womb, we're still being formed. We need a very definite environment. We need the confines of the womb in which to develop. If we were out in the world, we would not survive at that point. But once we've reached a certain level of development where we're clearly human, we're clearly going a certain direction, then we can be born in the womb. We still need a lot of nurturing and care, but we can be out in a more open atmosphere. And in many ways, our life here on earth is like our time in the womb. And when we go into the spiritual world, we're actually being born into our real life.
Yeah, George Stoll, there's a little complex of things that's been coming together. The first thing, in your opening prayer, you described this as place as a little bit of heaven. And then we read about heaven and heavenly homes, and they're magnificent, they're wonderful palaces, and they're not, you know, pine woods and so on and so forth. I think that says something about Swedenborg's own mind, and that we can certainly expect the kind of dwelling in which we really feel at home.
Right.
If we don't feel at home, in a cathedral or a palace. No, that's the Lord isn't going to say, "Oh, you got to live there."
Right,
right. The second that this image of life, heavenly life as service, we need to remember that in order for this service to be of any use, somebody has to need it.
Mm-hmm.
And that somebody also has to be us. We have to be willing, recognize our needs,
mm-hmm.
and be glad to be served.
Right.
And there's that wonderful bit I think it's paragraph 12 in Last Judgment, where he's saying that heaven is never full because everyone who arrives binds others more closely together.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone who comes into my life in a heavenly community is going to see things a little different. It's going to talk to me, and I'm going to say, "Wow, I never thought of it quite like that. Let's mm-hmm. do this together."
Mm-hmm.
And there will be a constant growth and development simply by this constant enrichment of the community. Yeah.
Thank you. F. Bob. Dave, did you want to?
As I'm going, just to add on to George's comment, I'm thinking of one person in particular at a church back in Hamburg, an elderly lady that had loved waiting on people and being a good Christian, helping people her whole life. And she was just very angry because now she was disabled and couldn't help people. And I told her, well, now you can let other people help you and do what you were doing. And I was trying to help her to understand that she could do a service by not letting other people serve her the way she enjoyed serving other people.
F. Bob. One of the things about our life here that is different in heaven, I hope, is that we're still struggling to find our gifts and talents, the love and wisdom that's in us, and we find ourselves having to do things we don't enjoy. And I'd like to misquote George that I heard him, as I heard him to say that it is a form of hell to want to do something but not know how to do it. And likewise, to know how to do something but not want to do it. And these are sorted out, at least as I heard George saying. And earthly thoughts, I remember going to Andover Newton Theological School, and theologians there, the chief end of, quoting Augustine, I believe, the chief end of man is to glorify God and enjoy him forever. And maybe that's where some of these poor folks find themselves in this one heaven you were talking about.
Well, you're giving me the opportunity to actually finish my lecture. I was aware that I was running out of time, and I didn't want to go too far over, so I kind of dropped off the last few lines of my notes here. Relating this whole experience to our life here on Earth, I got as far as we try out what we think is going to make us happy and find out that it doesn't really, and then we settle into finding something that does make us happy, which generally involves serving others. And at that point, the next thing that takes place in the story is they get to see a wedding in heaven. And Swedenborg tells us that a wedding or a marriage means the marriage of love and wisdom, or the marriage of goodness and truth. So your comment about it's hell to want to do something but not know how, is that what you said?
Yes.
When we've reached heaven, we'll never stay in that situation. Let's put it that way. We may still be striving, but we will have achieved a marriage of love and wisdom in which we will love to do something, and we will also have the knowledge of how to do it. And we'll be continually progressing in that love and knowledge. We'll never be at a point where we're just stopped dead because our desires are not being matched with the knowledge of how to do it, and our knowledge is not being matched with the desires. Those will continue to go in step with each other. And then the final thing about glorification of God, Jesus said to the people who had not served him, "As much as you have not done it to one of the least of my brothers and sisters, you haven't done it for me. Whereas as much as you have done it for one of the least of my brothers and sisters, you've done it for me." So yes, we spend our eternity glorifying God, but we do it by engaging in loving the people whom God has created. And God feels that as love and service and glorification. And I believe this is why the final portion of this story is a worship service in heaven. Because the real worship is service. It's service to others. It's what we're doing for others, and that is glorification of God. And just to completely finish my lecture, the final, you would think that that final tacked on epilogue about this really did happen, and I'm going to quote from the Bible and show you that others have seen similar things. This isn't a fantasy. Swedenborg is telling us, you may think that all this stuff I'm saying about heaven and what the joy of heaven really is and what it isn't is just fantasy. And in your younger years, you may say, he doesn't know what he's talking about. But he's telling us, I experienced this. This is as real as it gets. There is nothing realer than the experience that I'm giving you. And if you have similar experience, you will discover that for yourself. Yes, George.
George,
that's the finish of my lecture. The floor is yours again.
Yeah, one more real quickie, George Dole. It's an old saying I heard long ago. He was a man who lived for others. You could tell the others by their hunted look.
I'm not sure that's where I really want to end, but we are at time. So if you want to discuss this or the other lecture you're about to hear more, there will be an adult discussion group after the second lecture. And you're all welcome to attend, and that may be announced again after the second lecture, which will be given by George Dole. Thank you very much.